This is an interview of George Wheeler Govia in his home in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, on May 7, 1997. Dr. Govia, I know you were born June 15, 1917. Can you tell me something about your parents and your early childhood?
Yes, I was born in Nanton, Alberta. Nanton is a small town just south of Calgary, about 50 miles. And my father owned a small general store in Nanton.
What were your parents' names?
My father is George Arthur Govier, and my mother's maiden name was Gertrude Wheeler.
So you carry both?
I carry both
parent names in your name.
At home, I was always referred to by my middle name, Wheeler, because my father was George.
Yes.
But as I grew up, I became known as George.
What was your father's business in Nanton?
Well, he ran a small general store, retail merchandising.
You went to school in Nanton?
No. My father did quite well in Nanton, and then he and mother decided to move further west. They moved to Penticton, and he opened a store there. I started school in Penticton. Penticton is a town in central southern BC. I won't answer this. Turn that lower.
All right. So you went to school in British Columbia, where your family had moved, and graduated from high school there?
No, not quite. We didn't stay too long in Penticton. Dad's business didn't do well, and eventually he sold out, and I was, I guess, in about grade two, and we moved to Vancouver. And Dad had trouble finding a job. This was not the best time. Let me see, it would have been, about 1924, 25, somewhere in there. Dad finally got a job working for a men's furnishing store. And, of course, I continued school there, went to General Gordon School in the Kitsilano district of British Columbia, of Vancouver, met the girl who was to become my wife in grade four. And I continued through public school at General Gordon, then moved to high school at King Edward High, and graduated from high school in 1934, 35. Then I went on to the University of British Columbia.
Do you have any particular recollections of high school studies? Was it in high school that you became interested in chemical engineering?
Yes, it was. I was always interested in physics, math, and chemistry. And as I went through high school, I could see that the field of chemical engineering, which was rather new at that time, combined elements of math, physics, and chemistry. So it appealed to me from high school days.
And you knew what you wanted to major in when you went to the University of British Columbia?
Yes, I did.
Was there actually a Department of Chemical Engineering at British Columbia then?
No, it wasn't a full-fledged department. At UBC, the structure was a Faculty of Applied Science, which included the engineering departments and nursing, strangely enough, it being an applied science. There was a professor of chemical engineering, but not a full-fledged department.
Mm-hmm. And you took, I presume, all the chemical engineering courses they had to offer?
Yes, I did. There was quite a variety of courses in chemistry also, and not too many in chemical engineering itself. this was the time when the concept of unit operations was just being developed, and our professor, whose name was Sire, W.F. Sire, S-E-Y-E-R, he was very keen on the idea of unit operations. So our chemical engineering instruction was almost exclusively in that area.
Then, when you graduated, what did you do with your education in chemical engineering?
What I did was look for a job. I graduated in 1939. Jobs were very scarce. And I was finally fortunate to get a job with Standard Oil Company of British Columbia. Standard of BC operated a very small, almost tea kettle refinery on the outskirts of Vancouver. And I got a job with them really as a trainee engineer. I wasn't doing engineering or technical work at all. In fact, much of my work was more laboring than engineering, least of all chemical engineering. I remember very, very clearly the distaste I had for one of my functions, which was to steam out and clean recycled oil barrels. And I was on shift work, so it was an education in itself, but hardly in engineering.
Had you been strongly oriented toward the petroleum industry before you had that job?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't really thought much about the petroleum industry. But having had that experience or that contact with the refining industry, all aspects of the petroleum industry appealed to me. And I decided that if I was going to go ahead in the chemical industry or the refining industry, the best thing for me to do was to move my education forward. So I subscribed to a trade magazine published by McGraw-Hill. I don't know whether they still publish it. It was called Chemical Engineering, just that name. And it was a trade magazine. But one day I noticed an advertisement from the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Alberta. They were looking for I'm not sure if it was an instructor or a demonstrator. Anyway, a very lowly paid position in chemical engineering. So I inquired and found that I would be eligible for the job, and at the same time I could start work toward a master's degree in chemistry. So I applied for and got the job, and we moved to Edmonton in the fall of 1940. I was only with Standard BC for 1 year.
You had married while you were in college or just upon graduation?
We married in the spring of 1940.
Okay, so just before you moved to Alberta then?
Yes.
Okay. And did you take up both the responsibilities as an instructor and as a student at Alberta at the same time, or was there a lapse of years?
Well, there was a lapse of years because I found when I got to Alberta that the dean, whose name was R.S.L. Wilson, was counting on me to develop and give the principal course in chemical engineering. Like B.C., Alberta didn't have a formal department. It had two very strong men in the Department of Chemistry who had experience and leanings toward industrial chemistry and engineering, but no formal department. So I found myself extremely busy developing a course in unit operations and a laboratory in unit operations for the fourth year students who were registered in a chemical engineering program, which was made up by giving them selected courses from other faculties, from other departments. So I was too busy to start work on my master's degree, certainly the first year.
You must have had a rather extraordinary record yourself to be given such responsibility almost fresh out of your baccalaureate program.
Well, I did have a good record, Dr. Trainum, and I think looking back, the dean put an awful lot of faith in me at that time. But I must say it worked out quite well. I gained the respect of the students, and I worked very hard, and often the students and I were learning together, but I think they would, even the students of that first class, would agree that between us we did a pretty good job.
About how long was it before you undertook your own studies for master's degree?
Well, let's see, this would have been 40, 41. I think about 40, I think the next year I started and took advanced chemistry, advanced thermodynamics, advanced mathematics, and started a research project. And I can't remember just when I got my master's degree, probably in 45. And I continued teaching. I went back with Standard Oil for one summer, and then one, because, you know, we had time off during the summer, and I worked for an aluminum company, Aluminum Company of Canada, for one summer. And in 19, I worked for what was then called the Petroleum and Natural Gas Conservation Board, headquartered here in Calgary, and I'm sure we'll be talking more about this, but I worked one summer for that board in the Turner Valley oil field, which is the first big oil field in Alberta, discovered back in the 30s. And then I guess it was the summer of 46 that I went to the University of Michigan. I started in Michigan.
What prompted you to choose University of Michigan for further graduate study?
Two men. George Granger Brown, who was at that time the head of the Department of Chemical Engineering at Michigan, and his protege and colleague, Donald L. Katz, K-A-T-Z for you.
Yes.
Both of them had been engaged by the government of Alberta to advise on some technical problems in the Turner Valley oil field. And with my contact with the board, I became very much aware of the kind of work they were doing. And in essence, what they were doing was applying principles of physical chemistry, thermodynamics, and chemical engineering to the underground oil and gas reservoir. They were recognizing that oil and gas occurred in the porous spaces of rock, but in what was essentially a large confined chamber. And therefore, they also recognized that the behavior of the oil and gas mixture in this large chamber, if you like, mostly filled with rock but having pore spaces in which the fluid hydrocarbons exist, they recognized that that could be treated as a thermodynamic system, and predictions of behavior could be based on that. This intrigued me, so I inquired about Michigan. I found that it and MIT vied for a top position in the States at that time. I applied at Michigan. I got some financial help. I also I was granted a sabbatical from the University of Alberta 1 year ahead of time, which was very good of the university to allow that. And I think I got half salary from the university. Then I got some financial help from Michigan. So that was the start.
And you were at Michigan continuously until you got your doctor's degree?
No, I wasn't. Let me see if I can retrace this. I was there, I think, for 15 months which was the 12 months of my sabbatical plus a summer. Then I returned to Alberta and took up my teaching position again. By then, we had developed more courses in chemical engineering, and I was teaching two or three courses. And then I returned to Michigan for a further summer. I spent a total of, I think it was 24 or 25 months after my master's degree to qualify for my Doctor of Science. And I graduated from Michigan in 48, I think it was. Where's my Michigan certificate?
49, it says 49. On the summary here.
Yeah.
Or that was when the degree was granted.
Yes, that's right.
By that time, you had the rank of professor, I believe.
Yes, I did.
So you had a rather unusual record to move from lecturer to professor.
Well, not in one jump. But I was treated very well by the university.
And you became chair of the department then?
Yes.
And was that the first time there had actually been a department?
Yes.
So you were the founding chair of the department?
That's correct.
Tell me something about how you developed the department.
Well, of course, one of the problems was staff, and I was fortunate in attracting a UBC graduate who also went to the University of Michigan, Donald Robinson, attracted him to join the staff. Also, I was fortunate in getting a young man who had graduated from Alberta and had gone on to MIT and got his doctorate there. His name was Donald Kwon, Q-U-O-N. And Robinson and Kwon and I really were the heart of the department. We later engaged a young man by the name of Scott, and then there was pressure from the industry to have petroleum engineering. Our department at first was chemical engineering, and the curricula was more or less a standard chemical engineering program, no special reference to any industry, no reference to petroleum, other than that many of the courses had application in all industries. But the University of Alberta faced pressure to introduce petroleum engineering studies. So we engaged two other staff people who had training in petroleum engineering and offered a program in petroleum along with the program in chemical. The name of the department was changed to Chemical and Petroleum Engineering. And the bulk of the courses through the first 3 years, well, all the courses in the first 2 years were common. In the third year, there was some diversity between the chemical and the petroleum program. And in the fourth year, somewhat more. I remember our first class of petroleum engineers was something like 13 or 14 students. And it worked very well. The industry here was developing rapidly. We had our first major oil discovery in 1947. The oil field is called the Leduc Field, L-E-D-U-C. That was followed by another major discovery in Redwater, north and east of Edmonton. So the industry really exploded from about 1947-48 onward. And I don't know whether this is the right time to bring it up, but the Petroleum Natural Gas Conservation Board that I referred to earlier had been chaired by Dr. Edward Boomer, who was the senior professor in physical chemistry at the U of A when I first went there. And Boomer became chairman on a part-time basis of the PNNGCB, and there was a vice chairman appointed. This was pre-LaDuke. This was in about 40... This was 45, 46 in there. The preoccupation of the board was still the Turner Valley oil field, where there was a lot of wastage of gas and where there were problems of correlative rights. And I can enlarge on that later if you'd like me to. But Boomer was the part-time chairman. Boomer unfortunately died of a heart attack in 1945. The government was faced with a problem of what to do with the board. The vice chairman was appointed chairman. One of the senior geologists was appointed a board member. And that situation continued for until February of 48. At that time, or shortly before, the chairman resigned to go into private business, and the government again was faced with what to do. The government appointed a man by the name of Ian McKinnon, who was deputy minister in the provincial government department of energy, of lands and mines. And I was approached by the government to see whether I would become a part-time member, as Boomer had. But I wouldn't be chairman. I would be a part-time member, with McKinnon being a part-time chairman. I remember McKinnon and I didn't know one another. We met first in an elevator in your hotel, in the Palliser Hotel. We both lived in Edmonton. And we soon developed a great rapport and a great deal of respect for one another. We used to take the Sunday night midnight train from Edmonton, and we'd get up in the morning from the train, book into the Palliser Hotel, go over to the board office, which at that time was in an old warehouse building on 11th Avenue. You would have driven by it this morning, as a matter of fact. 11th Avenue and about 5th Street or 6th Street. And we stayed and we worked with the staff, which we were actually building up at that time, for 2 days, sometimes 3 days, and then we took the train back, the midnight train, back to Edmonton. And it was kind of a strenuous existence for...
Found so.
I don't know, 2 years, 2.5 years. Then Air Canada started a daily air service between the two cities with DC-3 airplanes. Do you remember the DC-3?
Oh, yes.
And we changed our procedure. We used to get up early Monday morning and catch the first flight to Calgary. We used to have breakfast on the plane, and the breakfast was a roll with pink icing on it, and a plastic cup with canned orange juice and some terrible coffee. Anyway, the plane made it a little easier, but we continued on that basis of 2 to 3 days a week in each city. This was the time, too, when, as I mentioned earlier, LaDuke had been discovered. Redwater was discovered in 48, shortly after we became involved with the board. And it was obvious that the responsibilities of the board were ballooning, and we needed staff. And this was where I had a great deal of fun, because here was an opportunity for me to put into effect the same sort of things that I had seen Brown and Katz do with respect to Turner Valley. So that was, that takes us up to around 1949.
48, 49. There was you were continuing as a professor and chair at Albert University.
Yes, I did, Dr. Trainum. And it was fairly strenuous, but I had a lot of energy, and I really enjoyed it. I didn't consider it to be work. I just enjoyed all of it.
What was the primary concern of the board on which you were serving as member right around the time of the discovery of the new oil fields?
Well, the concern was to establish rules for the spacing of wells, to establish safety measures for the drilling of wells, to consider at what rates the wells should be produced for maximum ultimate recovery, and to minimize the dissipation of reservoir energy. There was concern over what should be done with the gas that was inevitably produced along with the oil, and its conservation through a process of collecting it and then processing it in the field and then marketing the processed gas and liquid products. There was concern over correlative rights, and perhaps I should elaborate a little bit on that.
How do you define correlative rights?
Well, it it refers to the almost the reverse of the law of capture. In the early days, in the United States in particular, the rules of the game were anybody who drilled a well could produce the well literally at any rate he wished, and if it drained somebody else's property, so be it. And the owners of adjacent property, of course, always had the right to drill their own wells, but sometimes they didn't have the same marketing opportunities, and that might mean that if you had greater marketing opportunities than I and we were neighbors, you might produce your well at 1,500 barrels a day. I couldn't sell my oil, so I'd only produce at 100 barrels a day. Inevitably, you would be draining my oil away. Well, that was the law of capture. The converse of it, referred to as correlative rights, is the concept that you and I should have the right, the opportunity, to recover the oil beneath our tracts of land. And if I don't drill, that's my fault. You can produce and you will drain my land. But I have the right to drill. If I drill, the concept of correlative rights is that each of us would have the opportunity to produce proportionately. You would not be allowed to produce 1,500 barrels a day if I could only market 50 barrels a day. So in the conservation legislation here and elsewhere in North America, a very significant element is means for the protection of correlative rights. And this usually means rules relating to production, production quotas, production allowables. And this became a major concern of the board from about 1948 on.
Was there any particular experience in your background that prepared you for making decisions in this area?
Only my experience with Donald Katz and George Granger Brown I didn't work with Brown personally, but I became very much acquainted with his work. And